Good evening, everyone. I'm George Look, president of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, and I want to welcome everyone to the 464th meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum, and extend a special welcome to Governor Mills, who's attending the meeting, our meeting today. Governor Mills. This special forum meeting, which is being conducted at the Canavan Opera House, will be conducted in conversation with historian, author, and professor Heather Cox Richardson. And we're very pleased that she's able to come and be with us this evening. I'm sure the discussion tonight will cover a number of topics, but we should give a special focus to the ideas contained in Professor Richardson's most recent book, Democracy Awakening. There's nothing more central to the conduct of U.S. foreign policy than the health of our democracy, so it's something we need to really pay attention to. The forum was established 40 years ago. We meet each month and host speakers with differing perspectives on international issues to encourage the discussion of disparate viewpoints in the best tradition of our democracy. The Mid-Coast Forum is a volunteer organization, and I want to thank the very many volunteers, and you saw a lot of them here this evening, who helped make this meeting possible, with a special thanks to Jane Strauss and Tom DeMarco for putting an extraordinary amount of work into organizing tonight's event. And I'm pleased to be able to tell you that Professor Richardson will be able to stay for a limited time after the program to greet people on the third floor, where copies of her book, Democracy Awakening, will be available for sale. She will not be signing books this evening because she's signed already, but each of the books for sale has a specially designed book plate, which she has individually signed with her full signature and is pasted into the book. And I wish to thank Hello, Hello Books of Rockland for being here to sell books. The moderator tonight is Ms. Jo Dondas, who I believe most of you know from her active participation in many Mid-Coast organizations. Jo is a native of Rockland, started her career in television news here in Maine, and spent 24 years in California working as a television news producer. She won a Peabody Award for her work on the PBS program A Place of Our Own, and that is just one of the many awards she won for her work in television news. We are pleased to have Jo as a member of the forum, and I want to give a very heartfelt thank you to her for agreeing to moderate this conversation with Professor Richardson. Jo, they don't... Jo, no one wants to listen to me, so I want to turn the floor over to you to do a formal introduction of Professor Richardson and begin tonight's conversation.
Thank you. Well, good evening, everyone. I'm glad that we have such a full and enthusiastic house. Heather Cox Richardson is professor of history at Boston College. She has written about the Civil War, the Gilded Age, Reconstruction, and the American West in award-winning books, whose subjects stretch from the European settlement of the North American continent to the history of the Republican Party through the Trump administration. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Guardian, among other outlets, and she is the co-host of the Vox Media podcast Now and Then. Professor Richardson is also known for her Substack blog, Letters from Her from an American, and her latest book just out is, as George mentioned, Democracy Awakening, Notes on the State of America. So welcome. So with a new book and with over 1 million Substack subscribers, I'm probably not the first person to make this observation, but I cannot resist. You are the Taylor Swift of academia.
So thank you. I have to say, it's a huge pleasure to be here. I have waited for this all year. You know, this had to be rescheduled. And I'm home, which is fabulous, but I have to tell you that I'm especially excited to be here in Camden, because the first concert I ever went to, my brother took me to, and it was here to see David Mallon. And I believe that David Mallon and his wife are here tonight to hear me. And do you know that I cannot tell you how important that is to me. So I'm thrilled to be here, and thank you for welcoming me here. And let's get to it.
Let's get to it. So you've been called an independent journalist, and I know you don't characterize yourself as such, and I know you're going to be getting an award from the Authors Guild Foundation for Literary Activism. So are you a literary activist, and what does that mean to be one?
So this is a great question. You know, a lot of people think I'm a journalist, and I often get included in journalists' packs when they go places. But it's important to remember that journalists and historians are trained very differently. So what a journalist does is they tell you what happened. And that's their job. You know, they have scoops, they have contacts, they have people who can tell them the latest thing that's about to drop because something has just happened. They're trained to get that information, they're trained to get it to you very quickly. But historians are trained instead to study how and why societies change. So quite literally, we learn to use those sources that journalists provide, or that photographers provide, or that films tell you about, or documents, or any of the things that people leave behind them. We're trained to look at that and to understand how they interact and how they interact theoretically in order to change society. So different historians think that different things change society. Some people think it's economics, or some people think it's religion, or some people think it's great men. I happen to be somebody who believes ideas change society. So when I look at the world around me, I'm looking to see what pieces are moving people's ideas. So I don't cover the stuff that to me doesn't seem very interesting, like the Republican primaries this year. Like, what were they going to change? You know, honestly, Donald Trump was the front runner, and I wasn't going to sit there and listen to Chris Christie and Nikki Haley scream at each other, so I did the dishes, right? But often something will appear on social media that doesn't make the newspapers that says to me something's important. Like during one of those Republican primaries, President Joe Biden and Sean Fain of the UAW, the president of the UAW, recorded about 30 seconds together and put it on social media, praising each other. I wrote about that, because that showed that the labor movement was moving firmly into Biden's column. That mattered a lot more than whatever Nikki Haley had to say that night. So in terms of literary activism, it's an interesting thing because I'm a historian. And the idea that history is activism in this moment is a really interesting one, in part because there's a move afoot, and you probably haven't noticed, to erase our history and to turn it into something else. So I love the idea that somebody who is just, you know, kind of like the spider in the corner keeping score, which is what I do, is somehow an activist. I like the idea that those of us who watch and listen and remember our pasts are somehow changing society going forward, but also a threat to those who want to create a society that we dislike. I love the idea that we're sitting here knitting, like Madame Defarge,
well,
you know?
I'm also wondering whether this notion of being an activist ties into the way you speak in a powerful way to our cultural, political moment. Why do you think there is? There are other historians out there that are writing. There are other bloggers out there, but you have really kind of struck a chord, and I'm wondering why you think that is.
That's a really great question. Okay, so the answer is I don't do anything that is very exciting, and that sounds a little odd. I don't say anything that is necessarily brilliant or even all that different than most people understand, but I dare to take a moral stance about it. And there are not many people in the public sphere these days, I think, who are willing to take a moral stance and to say, you know, I like democracy, and here's why. I like the idea that people are treated equally before the law, and here's why. And simply being able to say, I'm proud to be an American, and I'm proud to hold these values, and these things are important things to carry forward, I think that's why people gravitate to me, not because I'm like Taylor Swift.
Okay. So let's talk about your new book for a couple minutes. In it, you explore the challenges to democracy and the path to authoritarianism, and you look at this through the lens and sweep of U.S. history. Why did you write it now? Why was it published now?
The book was intended originally simply to be a series of essays to answer the questions people ask me every day, sort of a how-to manual. How did the party switch sides? What was the Southern strategy? What on earth is the Electoral College? And do we live in a democracy or republic? You know, things like that. But as I started to write it, and I have to do a big shout out here. I told you this was friends and family night. My agent is here. None of this would have happened without my agent. None of any of this career would have happened without my agent. And she kept saying, you know, let's talk through this book. And, you know, as she always does very calmly, every time I say, it's not a book, we can't publish it, she says, I think it's probably okay. But as we talked about it, it became clear that the question people ask me every day is, how do we get here? What on earth does it mean to be in this moment? And how do we get out? So from the beginning, a number of people have said it's a really weird organization, the book, because it starts in 1937. There's a section that goes 1937 to 2016, I think. Then there's the Trump years through about 2021, and then the book starts again with the settlement of the North American continent by Europeans and goes through to the present in that last section. And people are like, what were you doing? I was answering, how do we get here, where are we, and how do we get out? And the answer to that in the book is that authoritarians destroy democracies by dividing people through the use of language and false history. That's what happened with the Republican Party from 1937 to 2016. Trump managed to bleed into that and take over the Republican Party, and he turned that group of people into a movement, this brand new thing in American history. And we get out of that by reclaiming American values and recognizing that true American history and true American language depends on the wedding of marginalized people to the ideas of the founders. Because the book argues that it's really marginalized people who've been excluded from those ideals, the idea that people should be treated equally before the law and have a right to a say in their government, both of which are enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, that it's the fact marginalized peoples have all along said, those are great, what about me? That means that we have managed to continue to hold those ideals high. And so that's why I wrote the book, that's how it came out, and that I think is what it does in this moment.
And the idea of people being marginalized, does that fit in with an observation that you write in the foreword of the book, that democracies die more often through the ballot box than at gunpoint? Does that fit into that notion that you describe, and are we in danger of losing our democracy through the ballot box, and how?
Yeah, this is a problem. The reality, I think, is that lots of people can't believe that the United States of America could lose its democracy. They really think that the guardrails are safe, that we have lived in the post-1933 and post-World War II world so long that, okay, you're going to switch from one person to another, but and one party to another, but really our democracy is safe. And it is not. It is not safe. Historians are looking at this moment and recognizing as we look around us the steps that we are taking that look very much like places like Germany in the 1930s. And one of the reasons I wrote that is because I think people say, what do you mean? It can't be that bad. I mean, we don't see tanks in the streets, and we don't, you know, yeah, people are getting beaten up and shot, but not a lot of them. And you know, what I wanted to make the point there was that elections really matter, and the things that we think are safe are not. So one of the things you may or may not have noticed is that although there was a lot of noise in the last 2 days about something to do with Biden, Trump explained how he was going to put in place his plan to get rid of 10 million migrants, immigrants, and first-gen Americans if he gets reelected. And that involves having teams of people round up about 10 million Americans, put them in camps at the border before expelling them. That could happen. And a lot of people think it couldn't. And one of the things that people like me are trying to do is say, you know, we live in the most privileged country in the world, but look at Ukraine. It could end in a heartbeat.
Well, since you brought up Trump, a lot has happened since your book came out. And the next Republican nominee for president is a person likely to be facing 91 felony charges. We have a Congress who's struggling around passing any meaningful immigration legislation and foreign aid legislation, in part because this potential Republican nominee seems to be calling the shots. Do we have a shadow president? Has this ever happened before in the history of our country?
You know, I have to laugh. You say a lot's happened since the book came out. The book came out in September. Aren't you tired of...
It's true.
Like, how many months is that? It feels like really a lot has happened, but, you know, it's not even been a year. Yeah, we're in a really crazy moment. I mean, and that's one of the things that's important to do when you see the rise of authoritarians is to recognize what the world normally looks like. Because think about what happened after Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. Anytime she even gave an interview, there were all these stories saying, she needs to get out of the way, she needs to shut up, you know, former people who run and lose, they're just supposed to go away. You know, Al Gore, like, he just went away, right? That's what you're supposed to do. Trump obviously did not go away, and he is in many ways doing what somebody has identified as running a shadow country, not even a shadow presidency, but a shadow country of people who believe things that are not true and who are trying to take over our government to impose their vision on the rest of us. Has this ever happened before? Absolutely not. And I always love that statement when, after Watergate, after Nixon resigns, in the next election, he actually went to the RNC and offered to help. You know what they said to him? They said, thank you, we think you've done enough.
Okay. I find that in your book, and certainly in your letters, that you always provide an historical context for what's happening in the world. And personally, I find that reassuring, that things may be bad, but they've happened before. So now you've just talked about a situation that hasn't happened before, which I find a bit chilling. But last weekend, I was really struck by the fact that Greg Abbott, governor of Texas, hosted 13 governors, all from red states. And they came to stand by him at a news conference to say, we're in charge of the border, not the federal government. Is this something that's, I mean, are we going to end up in a civil war?
So this is, I would like to talk about civil war too. I'm really interested in what's happening in Texas because Operation Lone Star, which is what Abbott has done now for about 2 years, has been around for a while now. And as you know, the Republicans are demagoguing, as you call it, demagoguing the immigration issue and the border issue. That's really all they've got to run on because the economy is fantastic. The abortion issue has absolutely caught them, you know, the dog caught the car on that one. And, you know, all the issues that they normally would run with, they don't have. So they've really been demagoguing the border and immigration. And Abbott especially, because Abbott is in Texas, where the abortion issue is huge. Remember that woman, Kate Cox? She's from Texas. Remember as soon as the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health decision came down in June of 2022, the first state that had that draconian law that said you can make money if you turn people in for obtaining an abortion, that was Texas. Women in Texas are really mad. And the Republicans need to win the women in Texas in order to be reelected in the whole cycle of 2024. In addition to that, up here, people didn't pay a lot of attention to it, I don't think, but Abbott was running from his last election forward on the idea of school vouchers. He really thought people in Texas were going to like school vouchers. But think about Texas. What do you do on Friday nights in Texas? You go to the football games. So by threatening to take away the public money for the football teams, he lost on that issue. So there's Abbott down there who's got the problem with the electrical grid. He's got the abortion issue. He's got everybody who likes football mad at him. He's really pushing the immigration thing. And that seems like it's a pretty safe bet because Congress has not been able to agree on any kind of immigration laws for a long time. So what do they say about the National Supplemental Security Bill, the Supplemental National Security Bill, to send money to Ukraine, Taiwan, Israel, and humanitarian aid to Gaza? They say, no, we don't want that until you push through some border deal thinking, hey, we're safe. And if you remember, the Republicans in the House went off for Christmas at that point. Actually, they went for Thanksgiving and then to Christmas. And the senators said, we actually really want Ukraine aid especially, so we're going to fix this. So they stayed through Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's, and they wrote the damn bill, right? So all of a sudden, if you're a Republican, you got yourself a real problem because they did it. And now there's not going to be that immigration law. There's not going to be the border bill any longer. And that's why the MAGA Republicans under Trump said, no, we're not going to go with this any longer. We're going to kill this because we want to make sure we still have that issue. Now, to go back to Abbott in Texas, so what does Abbott do? You probably read all the stories that said, oh, he's creating a civil war. He wrote a document. He didn't do anything. The Supreme Court said that the federal government has the right to come into the land that you say it can't come into, which is in that park in Eagle Pass, Texas, where they process migrants. And the Texas people had walled that off with razor wire. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. You have to let them in, which so far, as near as I can tell, is actually happening. Abbott writes this document that gets all kinds of press that says we have the right to do this. So Abbott has been trying to push the idea that Texas can have more control over its border for a while now, but he hasn't done anything. He just wrote that document. So why am I making such a big deal about this? A lot of the Republican-dominated governors jumped on board that and said, hey, yeah, we're about all this too. We are going to fight off the federal government and so on. To me, so far, it looks like posturing, but their followers don't think it's posturing. And this is the reason I sort of gave you this big windup. Did you ever think about why we had the Civil War? I mean, aside from the obvious that it's about enslavement and the continuation of slavery in our country, why it happened then? What happens is that the elite Southern enslavers want to continue to control American government, and they're very aware that they no longer command a majority. And so after Lincoln is elected in 1860, he's not going to be inaugurated until March of that year. We don't switch until the January inaugurations until FDR's term, until after FDR. It's during FDR's term. It happens FDR after FDR. But so the legislature of South Carolina is the only legislature in the country that chooses its electors itself rather than giving it to the people. So they're actually sitting when Lincoln is elected. And they're all drinking. It's the holiday season. Planting season is over. They go into Christmas and they say, we're going to have our own country. We're going to do this. And a lot of other states are out there with them too saying, oh, we're going to do this. This is going to be great. And they're cheering each other on, and everything's going to be great, and they're going to take on the U.S. government. And then spring happens, Lincoln gets in office, nothing happens. And all their followers are like, wait a minute, weren't we going to have a revolution here? So when the U.S. government brings down its ships to reprovision Fort Sumter, the Confederate government has a real fight about what they should do because they know it's probably not a great idea to fire on the U.S. government, but they recognize that if they don't do it, South Carolina is going to. And so in order to preempt South Carolina, the Confederacy fires on the U.S. government, and that's why the timing happens the way it does. And the whole reason I told you all that is because to go back to Abbott and the border, I think Abbott is trying to set up a new Supreme Court case that he's got going on right now and try and giving it more ammunition. But I'm not sure his followers recognize that this is not a game. And that's what worries me.
Okay. In your January 27th letter, you write about Lincoln's Lyceum address, in which a 28-year-old Lincoln talks about the rule of law and says, "Let reverence for the laws become the political religion of the nation." I love that phrase, political religion. Do we have a political religion today? If so, what is it? If not, are we in danger of letting the rule of law slip away?
I would argue that we had a political religion until the 1960s. And what happened was, after World War II, both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party embraced the idea that the government had four tasks to do. A new kind of government had four things to do. It was supposed to regulate business, it was supposed to provide a basic social safety net, it was supposed to promote infrastructure, and it was supposed to protect civil rights. And that becomes known as the liberal consensus. And it's the liberal consensus because both Republicans and Democrats believe in that. So what happens is that if you look at debates that happen in the United States in politics before 1960, including the Kennedy-Nixon debates, you recognize they're very substantive. They're all about what steps people take to protect democracy and to protect a government that does these things. But in 1960, there's a famous article that's written by a political scientist, and he's talking about how to win elections, and he says to people, stop talking about ideology, stop talking about principles, because we all agree. You're not turning out voters based on democracy any longer. You need to turn them out based on coalitions. You people will get this from my version of democracy, and you people will get that from that version of democracy, and people should choose based on coalitions. And with that, and with the confusion that happens in the 1960s, you get the movement away from the idea of protecting democracy, at least on the part of the Republican Party. The Democrats, of course, are defending it after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, although they're doing it in a very different kind of language at that point. And the country moves away from that idea that we need to move our society in such a way that it protects democracy both at home and overseas. Because remember, those people had lived through World War II. They had lived through the concentration camps. They recognized that the systems of government that protected people's rights were very, very fragile. And so I think one of the things you're seeing now, and to go back to why you think people read me, is because a lot of people don't understand any longer what is at stake in an election. You think a lot of people I talk to, especially people who are not politically involved, say, well, it doesn't matter. You know, they're all the same. It doesn't really matter what happens. And we had the luxury for a long time of feeling that way in the United States. And we don't any longer. So I don't think we do have that officially. But that being said, one of the reasons that I'm out on this tour and one of the things that I see that it is not getting reported in the media at all is that there is a movement in this country. There's a movement of people who want to protect democracy, they want to recreate that liberal consensus, and they want to get rid of the people in our governments, both at the state and the national level, who are trying to destroy Americans' rights. And that reminds me very much of the 1890s when, you know, the populist movement, First the Alliance movement, and then the populist movement swept the country and lawmakers simply didn't know it was out there. And they were like ducks hit on the head after the election of 1890 when the Republicans had expected to win both the Senate and the House of Representatives, and they lost the House by a 2-to-1 margin to the Democrats and the Alliance movement that's going to become the populists. And then they also lost control of the Senate. And there's this wonderful letter that somebody writes after visiting the president, Benjamin Harrison, in his garden after the election. And she says he just wandered around going, I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. All I know is it wasn't my fault. Which explains everything you need to know about Benjamin Harrison.
So before we pivot to audience questions, I want to ask you one more thing. It sounds like you're optimistic that democracy will survive, people need to get out to vote. What would the failure of democracy, of US democracy, mean for the rest of the world?
So I am optimistic that in a free and fair election, there is absolutely no doubt that we are preserving democracy. You asked me before what keeps me up at night, the degree to which extremists who are trying to destroy democracy have sewn up what I call the nodes of the mechanics of our democracy, and maybe we can talk more about that. But one of the things that actually tonight's letter is written, and what I'm looking at is, you probably didn't hear it, and I was sort of being snide about the focus that has been paid to the report of the special counsel, Robert Hur, about Biden. Is it 2 days ago now? I've lost track of time. Which has taken up all the oxygen, and it's problematic. But the other thing that happened is the Senate voted to advance, not to pass, but to advance a new national security supplemental bill that would provide money to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. Now, they've cut out the Pacific Islands and the Indo-Pacific in that current bill, although there's a move to put that back in place. There is no guarantee that it will pass the Senate, and the MAGA Republicans in the House are already saying they won't pass it. But so this is not theoretical. What happens to the world if the United States backs away from the idea of a rules-based order both at home and internationally is that we go back to two things. We go back to a world in which the United States is isolated, and we go back to a world in which there is not a system of rules and values that underpin the ways in which people interact across nations, because that's the whole point of a rules-based international order. Now, that doesn't mean people don't break those rules, but it does mean that there are rules. There's a language with which people can apply to things like the international criminal courts, saying this country is not supposed to be doing this, and it is. And it gives people a language to challenge that and to try and put that ground back underneath the idea of rules between different countries. Now, what Vladimir Putin is doing, and Xi Jinping to some degree, and Viktor Orban, I mean, I could keep on going on a list down here, but especially right now, Russia is what we're looking at. Russia is trying to get rid of that international rules-based system. It doesn't want that. It wants to be able to absorb Ukraine, which is incredibly valuable real estate, among other things, but also great ports. It wants to be able to get rid of the idea that it has to behave in a way that is acceptable to other nations. And you may not have been paying attention to this. I did a really deep dive on this and was fascinated by it, and then never had a chance to write it up. I mean, I did write it up. I never published it, and poor buddy has heard about Venezuela and Guyana more than he ever wanted to. But Russia is doing the same thing by pushing Venezuela to take over Guyana. I don't know if you've seen that in the news, but Venezuela has just declared that 2/3 of Guyana belongs to it. Just declared it, which is, you know, a one approach. If we lose that idea that human society should be based on agreed upon rules, both domestically and internationally, we will go back to a world in which might makes right, autocrats have the power to rule, and when I look forward, you know, normally you can say, well, it's going to be really miserable for a generation or two, but we're going to come around again. It's going to suck on the way, but we'll come around again. We got climate change out there. We got climate change, and we've got migration that's going to be caused by climate change, and we've got the diseases that are going to be brought by climate change, and it really looks, I'm actually quite an optimistic person in general, but we got to get this one right. You know, a friend of mine always says to me, you know, you people worry so much. By 2028, the demographics that vote in the United States are such that it's going to be a democratic romp. I mean, it's going to be an entirely new country. And I always say back to him, Tom, we need to make sure there is a 2028 election, which makes this election ours and the one that really matters.
Okay. So we're going to turn to questions from the audience. I'm going to ask you all to be very considerate of your neighbors and please ask short, direct, concise questions. We don't need to know your name. We don't need to know where you're from. We don't need to know that you're happy to be here. We know that you're happy to be here. Please just get right to your question. And George Look, who is our fearless leader, is going to start out, as he always does, with first question. So, George.
Yes, I was going to stick with the Midcoast Forum tradition and ask the first question tonight. I wanted to ask, you know, given the situation you've explained about political and situation and the status of democracy, should the U.S. be pushing democracy in other parts of the world now? And if so, how should we do that to be really effective at it?
Okay, so I did not pay him to say that, but one of the things that frustrates me a little bit is that people don't, and I shouldn't say people don't seem to understand, they have not been given the tools to understand, because I have to say, there's been a lot going on that I was about to criticize somebody, and I'll walk that one back. The United States is not currently trying to spread democracy. If you remember, out of the box, Biden came out and kept talking about, on the one hand, authoritarianism, and on the other hand, democracy. And he stopped doing that within about 6 to 8 months. And the reason for that is there is a new foreign policy doctrine coming out of the Biden administration that basically nobody is talking about. It's there if you read the State Department every day, which I do. They've got a terrible name for it that I probably won't share with you because I'm like, could they put another syllable in those three words? But what they are trying to do is to recognize that the idea of spreading democracy has always had an element of colonialism in it. And that is not going to work in the global south, and it's certainly not going to work in Africa. So how do you create a world in which people get to have self-determination in whatever kinds of governments under which they want to live, not necessarily democracies, but governments that they are at least reflecting human rights within states? How do you do that? How do you work together? And what the Biden administration has done is it's taken its cue from the European Union, which recognized when they tried to put all those different countries together that economically they couldn't make it work. You know, somebody wanted cheese and somebody else didn't want cheese. Believe me, I'm making fun. There were bigger problems than that. But they recognized that what they had to do was they had to sort of be willing to jockey and to work together on certain things and not work together on certain things. So the Biden administration has taken that to a global level, focusing on diplomacy. And they're talking about this this system imposing diplomacy on this idea of the jockeying. So what they have done is they have created what I have privately called ad hoc committees, but what you'll know it sort of as regionalism, that word comes up, is they've created organizations around the world that are designed to deal with a specific problem. So for example, there's a fentanyl committee around the world. I don't know if you know that. They just met for the fourth time in Mexico 3 days ago. And that puts together Mexico, the United States, Canada, and China to try and deal with the precursor chemicals and with the importation of fentanyl across the U.S. borders. There's the kinds of organizations that they have in the Indo-Pacific now that are designed to work on things that are that relate to the Indo-Pacific, and of course the U.S. wants a seat at that table because it keeps saying we're a Pacific nation too. So if you think about that balloon that was such a big deal in the United States, the United States knew that China was spying on us. That was not news. But some of the Indo-Pacific countries didn't know that China was spying on them. So that was a case where they're like, hey, maybe we all ought to work together on this. There's all these places where the administration has tried to put together, the Pacific Islands is another one, have tried to put together these, they're called different things. They're called trilateral committees, or they're called different, they have different names, but they have tried to put together a way to create a small d democratic kind of system without exporting big D democracy or American democracy with a recognition that comes with colonialism. So they have tried to include Africa as well on this. This is why Africa is now part of the G20. The African Union is part of the G20 because of Biden insisting that it be there. So the kicker here, of course, is that this is an entirely new way to look at foreign affairs. And if Ukraine doesn't get funded, and the Pacific Islands came out 2 days ago and said, you know, we really thought we were going to work with you, but you haven't funded anything you said you were going to fund. And mind you, it's not a huge amount of money for the Pacific Islands. China's looking real good to us right now. And so one of the things that I wish people understood better is, first of all, this major shift, about which I'm an agnostic, by the way, but I like the idea of democracy without colonialism. And the fact that what they're doing in Congress by not passing any bills, and certainly not passing these funding bills, is not just handing Ukraine to Russia. It's destroying this entire set of underpinnings that Biden has worked so hard to put together. And you know, I think that this, honestly, I'll say it, I think the State Department should have done a much better job explaining what they were doing. So should America be doing this? I think so. I think it beats the hell out of Vladimir Putin taking over countries and bombing apartment houses, but that's what's going on.
Number four.
Was my seventh grade civics teacher wrong to tell me that the system of checks and balances that we have between the Congress, the executive, and the judiciary is what will ultimately protect us?
Well, in that era, no. But this is a real question, because when the framers wrote the Constitution, they were very clear about the idea that they expected that the prerogatives of the different lawmakers and judges in the different places would mean they would be so determined to protect their own power that they would guarantee it didn't get too strong elsewhere. And of course, what they didn't know about was the rise of political parties. So, which is going to happen pretty quickly under Washington's first term, and it's really going to get politicized under my friend and buddy Thomas Jefferson. That's a joke. I don't like Thomas Jefferson. And one of the things that really just put my hair on fire was in the first impeachment of Donald Trump. Or you could even go when all the senators said they knew he was guilty, but it was about winning they were going to let him walk because they wanted to win the 2020 election. But you could go even before that. You know, I was rereading a bunch of Russia stuff today, and you know, the Obama administration knew that Russia was interfering in the 2016 election, and they called in the Gang of Eight, which is the leaders in the intelligence committees and the leaders of both the House and the Senate, and said, we got ourselves a problem. We need to make an announcement saying to the American people saying this is happening, and we got ourselves a problem, and we got to clean this up. And Mitch McConnell wouldn't do it. Mitch McConnell would not do it. When they finally could agree on a statement, it was so watered down, nobody understood there was a problem. So one of the things that I think we've got to deal with is the fact that our checks and balances were always norms rather than laws. And that's because the framers trusted that men would be so self-interested they would not give everything up to a party. And now we know that's wrong.
One.
Hello, Heather. Good evening. My name is Andre Blanchard.
No.
Oh, sorry. I want to thank you very much for your writing your two books that I've read.
No, please get to your question.
Sorry. Oh, okay.
Question.
Our movement conservatives who seem to have taken over the entire Republican Party and the oligarchy that you write about that controls our country through bot politicians and judges. Are they one in the same group?
This is a great question. What he's talking about are the people I identify as movement conservatives. I don't actually identify them as that. They identified themselves as that. That's a long, interesting story. But they are not true conservatives. That is, they don't embrace the ideals of conservatives. They were a movement that called itself conservative, a political movement that called itself conservative, the same way the Fox News channel calls itself the Fox News channel, even though it was never a news channel. And people made that mistake, and they did the same thing there. And so yes, the movement conservatives were the ones who wanted to destroy that liberal consensus, and there were so few of them that when somebody wrote a history of the Republican Party in 1973, I think it was, they never even mentioned them. But what they did is they managed to capture a number of important media and outlets at the same time that there was a real backlash against the Voting Rights Act of 65, and they managed then to, they first managed to court Dixiecrats into the Republican Party in 1964 with Barry Goldwater. Strom Thurmond switches from being a Dixiecrat to being a Republican, and then Nixon, of course, literally goes to him and says, I will not interfere with use of federal government to interfere with segregation in the states if you stay Republicans, and Strom Thurmond stayed on the Republican side at that point. So yes, that was the ideology that took over the Republican Party, and it really took off and took over the party in the 90s under Newt Gingrich, and with the bleeding out of the party of those that the movement conservatives called rhinos, Republicans in name only, although they were actually the traditional Republicans, including, of course, the president, which is sort of astonishing. George H.W. Bush went down to the Gingrich people. But now we're in a very different moment, and this is an important thing to remember. In 2016, the movement conservatives were running the show. They wanted to get rid of a government that regulated business. They wanted to get rid of a social safety net. They wanted to cut taxes. They wanted to turn infrastructure over to individual private enterprise, and they didn't want to use the government to protect civil rights. That's what they wanted. But they had front-loaded the Republican caucuses and primaries in low-information states, recognizing that people would gravitate toward people whose names they recognized. Jeb Bush was going to win, right? Even before anything was going to happen, Jeb Bush had a giant war chest and he was going to win. Name recognition. And then Donald Trump arrives. Better name recognition. Since Trump took over the party has changed. The old Republicans, there are still a lot of old Republicans who are like, this is not my party anymore. What on earth is going on here? The people who now run the Republican Party, and I have to say the people who now own the Republican Party, are articulate about their determination to destroy democracy. This is no longer like, maybe we'll play in the edges. They are on board with the program that Viktor Orban put in place in Hungary when he destroyed Hungary's democracy. Quite literally, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has been using the blueprints of laws from Hungary to apply them in Florida. Things like the Don't Say Gay bill is from came directly from Hungary, and they are talking about how important it is to get rid of equality before the law that protects the rights of LGBTQ plus people and women and people of color, Black Americans. They are deliberately trying to get rid of the pieces of American democracy that they think poison our society. And in order to do that, rather than trying to create a little government the way people like Ronald Reagan talked about, or Mitch McConnell, or anybody in between them, they want a big, strong government that's going to make everybody adhere to their particular religious values, their evangelical Protestant religious values, although they haven't specified which Protestant evangelical religious values, which would be a really interesting debate if they ever get to it. So it's important to remember that, yes, that's who they were, but in the last 2 years, we're dealing with an entirely new Republican Party. Big government, not small government. Theocracy, not separation of church and state.
To expand on your answer just a little bit, in order to remove extremists from power, wouldn't the two mainstream parties at some point have to unite? And that seems far in the future from what you're describing.
Well, so listen, one of the things that I've said for years, people say to me, is the Republican Party dead? And I would say, no, it's got email lists, it's got lots of money, it's got these institutions, both personal loyalty and, you know, the way parties work. But one of the things that's happened under Trump is he very deliberately, when he was in power, put his own people into the state parties. Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, Florida, you know, all the ones that you know are in trouble. And they backed him and used the email lists for fundraising for him. Now, if you've looked, you know that the Republican Party has like no money right now. I mean, they're trying to get this $10 million loan because they're in such trouble. Well, where's the money gone? The money's all gone to Trump. And where has the money gone from Trump? It's gone into his legal bills. $50 million have gone this year into his legal bills. So one of the things that I think is interesting right now is the Republican Party really, the real Republican Party really gone in such a way that those remnants of it can join with the Democrats right now in this anti-Trump party, the anti-MAGA party that will later on split. And you know, I'm watching this, what's happening in the Senate, really carefully, because the fact that the senators came out yesterday, and again, didn't get a lot of attention, but came out yesterday and re-upped this national security bill after Trump and the MAGA Republicans killed it last Wednesday, I think is really interesting. I think Mitch McConnell is fighting for control, at least of his wing of the party. And Mitch McConnell is 84 years old, and he's just had a really bad health thing, and I'm not sure he's going to pull it off. And that's going to say a lot about which direction the country goes.
Mm-hmm. One.
You have had extraordinary and well-deserved success with your newsletter. I think it's in the tradition of Hector Crevecoeur, who had a similar
title.
Yeah. Alistair Cook and I.F. Stone, yeah. Maybe predecessors.
Yep.
Who did you go to learn how to write a newsletter that way on current political issues so successfully?
I went to you guys. All I do is I explain things to people. I'm a teacher, and if people don't understand stuff, they tell me. I mean, believe me, you piss off 1.5 million people every night. They tell you when it's not clear, right? So you know, at this point, you know, I'd written a number of books before. I did not intend to start the letters. I literally was answering questions for friends on Facebook. And at this point, I've written, I think it's over 2 million words in this project. And I call it my Beatles in Germany moment. If you write more than 2 million words, you get pretty good at putting them together. So it's you people saying, what do you mean by that? Wait a minute. And, you know, I think of E.B. White. You know, he used to talk about just getting your reader out of the swamp. That's all I do. I get readers out of the swamp.
Three.
Good evening, Ms. Richardson. After reading your book, Democracy Awakening, I was left with a feeling, actually, that where we are today does not really bode well for democracy. My question is, what role did the Democratic Party play in this situation? Are they entirely blameless?
So this is a great question. The Democratic Party, somebody said to me, why don't you write more about the Democratic Party? And the answer to that in this moment is, it's very different than it was when I finished the book. They aren't the problem. You know, the problem is the takeover of the Republican Party by this small group of people. But yes, you know, one of the things I think that we're looking at right now in the Democratic Party is the fact, it seems to me, if you look at what happened to the parties after the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, is that both parties had to grapple with what do you do if you're going to have a multicultural democracy. And the Republicans quite clearly went the direction of Goldwater and Nixon and Reagan into, well, we're just going to become white nationalists. I'm skipping ahead a little bit. But the Democrats initially begin by saying, well, we're going to have a multicultural party. This seems like just a ducky idea, right? So they begin to open up the nomination process for more people. They try and become more inclusive. And what do they get? They get the 1968 Democratic National Convention, which, by the way, is that's a much more interesting story than people know. The reason it was so violent in part, or so troubled in part, was because the place it was supposed to be held burned down, and they held it somewhere else that was very close to Mayor Daley's house. And he didn't want the kind of trouble that was happening, first of all. But second of all, the Republicans had their convention on an island that had two bridges that could be stopped. So the Republicans, just physical geography made a big difference there. But after 68, what the Democrats do is they decide that they're going to find a way to create a situation where there's a little bit more control over the party and who gets nominated and who gets to participate in the party. And what they end up doing in the 70s, first of all, is they create a nominating system that gets them first George McGovern, and then after George McGovern, they begin to pull back on that and recognize that they think they need to stop trying to court these new voters and to try to get back the voters that they lost after 65. So the Democrats kind of go into the wilderness for a while, and one of the things that I think that we are, at the same time that they embrace the idea of the new left, the idea that rather than working together as the labor unions, for example, are in big groups, what people really need to do to change American politics is to recognize their own self-worth, which is really hard to build a political movement around. But one of the things I think we're seeing under Biden is the final fruition of what it means for a political party to embrace multicultural democracy. And I think that's one of the reasons that there is such a divorce right now between the Republicans, who have gone full-on white nationalist, and the Democrats, who are going increasingly on to, hey, we're a multicultural democracy. We're actually going to recognize that the base of the party is black. It's not white. You know, the Democrats haven't won the white male vote, a majority of the white male vote, since 64, right? So I think that you're seeing that play out now. And, you know, I could go on more about the Democrats, but I didn't in that book because they're not the problem in this moment, and it was a short book.
Two?
I'm curious, Dr. Richardson, in regards to Ukraine funding. I'm here. I'm sorry. Yeah. In regards to Ukraine funding, do you think President Biden has any leverage to help get that passed?
I will tell you, he's using every piece of leverage he has, because I think he recognizes that this is literally a make or break. But, you know, the president does not have authority to hand over that kind of money on his own. and he's done everything he possibly can under different kinds of laws. And we don't want the president to have that kind of leverage. We really don't. I think that if he did that, it would be a good thing in terms of the outcome. But I don't want the president to be able to say, yeah, I'm going to support this war and not that one. I mean, that really is the Congress's job. So the answer is no, I don't think there's more that he can do than he is doing now. And this fight in the Senate right now and what happens in the House, it's one of those funny moments. Sometimes there's these small things that happen that nobody pays a lot of attention to, and they're earth-shattering. And this one's earth-shattering. So over the last 3 days, if you're interested, you can follow this website out of England called the Institute for the Study of War. Nonpartisan. They're all military people, and they will tell you what is happening everywhere. And they will tell you with what degree of certainty they are that something's happening. And in the last week, Russia's been making all kinds of gains. You know, you kept hearing in the news in the U.S. that Ukraine wasn't doing very well. They got back 50% of the land that Russia had taken over the course of the last year. They crippled Russia in the Black Sea. They continued to open the ports so that grain was getting into Africa, which is a huge deal, because if Africa starts to starve, we got a really big problem down there as well. And they're losing it because they don't have ammunition. They can't fight back. And I'm wondering when that's actually going to hit the media and people are going to say, these poor people took this back inch by inch, and now they're getting pushed back because they don't have bullets. I mean, this is crazy. So I don't know. I think he's done everything he can do.
Three, upstairs.
How are you picking these?
Numbers.
Yeah, but
I can see numbers, not faces.
But you're not going in order.
What?
But you're not going in order.
No, I'm going downstairs, upstairs.
Oh, okay.
Random.
You had mentioned that it's the sort of the white Protestant evangelical group of values, but at the same time you have Leonard Leo, who's really put a lot of Catholic Supreme Court justices in place. So it's sort of a combination. It's sort of a two-part question. I mean, there's been an awful lot of coordination between, like, the Federalist Society, changing the media laws under Reagan, when the radio stations and the newspapers started having financial difficulties, very rich Republican bought all of them up. They gutted their news stations. They control. They now, right, the local press is really putting out a coordinated message across, you know, to all these rural areas. And this has really been happening. This planning has been 60 years in the making. And so for history, how does this all work together? I mean, when you're viewing this from a historian standpoint of all of this working together and coming forward, how much coordination was there in the early days?
One of the things that I think really matters is that people didn't think that anything that we valued was under threat. And you still hear this when people say, oh, they're never really coming for Medicare. That's a scare tactic. They're never coming for Medicare. They are. There are bills already written, you know, but people believe that those guardrails are in place. So, for example, one of the things that happened with the movement conservatives was that they recognized that they were not able to get people to vote for the idea of gutting this liberal consensus. So instead, what they needed to do was to advance an ideology that started from the premise that we were going to protect religion and we were going to protect what they called free markets. You know, the idea that you shouldn't have any kind of regulation of business. And they were going to push that through the media, academia, and especially the courts. And that's when people like Leonard Leo come in after 1971, when Lewis Powell writes the Powell Memo, which he writes for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He was a lawyer for the Chamber of Commerce. And he said, we got a real problem because everybody likes this government that we don't like. So how are we going to take it back? Well, we're going to have to push back on these specific places. And this is where you get the idea, for example, that academia is liberal or that the media is liberal. That means that the media embraces the idea of a fact-based discourse, and when people hear facts, they tend to vote for a government that does the things that the liberal consensus wanted the government to do. So that idea that these are liberal institutions, yes, they're fact-based institutions. So that's 71 when he writes the Powell memo, and very deliberately people recognize the need to have think tanks, for example. This is when we get Mackinac and all the and Heritage and all the right-wing think tanks that are designed to turn out people to go into business, to go into law, to go into academia, and to go into the media. And that idea of pushing those people into positions of power in the United States, yeah, that's from the 1970s. The Federalist form in the 1980s, it's either 84 or 86, to push back against the use of the Supreme Court to protect civil rights. That's what the Federalist Society is all about, and the idea of cutting that liberal consensus government and stopping the Supreme Court from using the power of the 14th Amendment to enforce civil rights in the states and to enforce business regulation. So it's been going on for a very long time, and one of the things that always strikes me in the moment we're in is how much we look like the 1850s, when elite Southern enslavers had in fact done the very similar thing in the United States and in the United States government in the 1840s and the 1850s and had taken over the system. And most people haven't paid attention. It's a democratic country, right? And what did it matter if the Democrats won a bunch of elections? You know, surely they weren't all that bad. And finally they woke up in 1854 and recognized that the elite Southern enslavers had taken the presidency, the Supreme Court, and the Senate. And in 54, it became clear that they also had control of the House of Representatives. And when that happened, Americans sort of sat up and said, wait a minute here, we have a problem. And between then and 1863, they managed to take back American democracy. And that's what that looks like to me in this moment.
Two.
Could you please talk about the youth, the young vote? Because you have a captive audience, and all of us have young people, and knowing how important this election is, can you speak to that?
The Ute is a friend of mine used to say. The Ute.
Or will you tour with Taylor Swift? Because we know she supports Biden.
Well, so the Ute, first of all. relational organizing, we know, is better than anything else. Tell your people to vote. But one of the things, and don't believe the things that say that young people don't like Biden. The polls all show the young people adore Biden. And even more than that, they really, really, really like Vice President Kamala Harris. They really like her. And that's not getting put out in the press at all. So young people like him. The issue is young people actually turning out to vote. And a lot of young people are not socialized to vote. That is, I assume your kids and grandkids all vote, but that's not always the case, especially for people who've come from other countries where they weren't allowed to vote, for example. So one of the things that a number of organizations are working on doing this year is making sure that people register to vote and turn out to vote. And one of the ways you can participate in that is through relational organizing, making sure that people actually are registered and actually show up. That's the good news. The bad news is that most young people, I shouldn't say most young people, a number of young people get their information from TikTok and from Instagram. And those are both polluted, and I use that word deliberately, by bots and trolls, many of whom are recycling information that's coming from China, Iran, and Russia. And that's deeply problematic going into this election. And we have a real problem in the United States because of the First Amendment, which I'm a huge supporter of. The government cannot come in and say, don't do that, because that's a violation of of the First Amendment, which says that the government can't interfere with the press. What the government could do is it could interfere with algorithms. And I've been pushing that really hard to say that, you know, you simply can't amplify these fake accounts that are happening the way they are. And the U.S. has been really slow off the block about that. The European Union has laws in place to protect privacy and has AI laws in place. Now, we've had an executive order go in, I think it was last October, that says that Biden's trying to make sure that anybody who produces AI images, they have to be watermarked. Well, you know, that and $5 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks, because that means you actually have to go into it and see. It doesn't show up as you go by it. I'm very concerned about that going forward. So the Ute are all right. They want gun safety legislation, first of all. They want climate change they want climate change addressed. They want equal rights for everybody. I mean, they're really in a lot of really good places, and by all the statistics suggest that by 2028, they're running the show. But like I say, it's 2024 that we gotta get through.
Three upstairs.
Hi, I was wondering what you thought about where our country and democracy would be if Trump had won.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I was wondering where you thought democracy would be right now and the country if Trump had won.
We would not be here.
Okay.
No, I'm dead serious. I do this for a living, right? I'm reading this stuff all the time. It is terrifying what is out there. It is terrifying what his supporters talk about. And by supporters, I don't mean the people on the street. I mean the people who will be in another administration. They talk about rounding up journalists. They talk about throwing people in prison. They talk about rounding up 10 million Americans and putting them in concentration camps. And you sit there and you say, well, that really can't happen, right? Well, tell that to the people in Germany in the 1930s. You know, and that, I think he has made it very clear who he is and what he wants. And what he will do if he gets back in power and what that will look like. You know, we debate this, as, you know, historians talk about this because we're fun. You know, there is a sense perhaps that because of the increased focus on states' rights, that perhaps people in states that have really excellent governors, like the state of Maine, will at least have personal safety. But I'm telling you, I don't like the way it looks. I really don't. So anybody thinks they can sit this one out because they think Biden is a weenie or whatever, you can't.
We have time for a couple more questions. So number two.
So you mentioned that moral issues are very important to you. And for me, so the key moral issue that I have right now is internationally, so the slaughtering in Gaza. And so what do you think about the U.S. supporting Israel with military and money in this war? And would that not deter just the youth in the next election?
So yes, the youth are very upset about that in part, and who wouldn't be? Like when what you're seeing are the images out of Gaza. But one of the things that concerns me very much about the way we have talked about Gaza is the larger question. That is, first of all, Biden has never liked Netanyahu. Biden likes Israel. And there's a reason for that, and there's a reason that he stood behind Israel the way he did. Now, just remember what happened, and it's worth remembering that Netanyahu was strong going into October 7th. He had, you know, he'd been a leader in Israel for 15 years, I think it was, not all consecutively. And there was very little that one could do to challenge Netanyahu at the time, right? Then October 7th happened, and Netanyahu's popularity is because of the fact that he said he'd been able to keep Israel safe. October 7th tears that all apart. So what do things look like on October 8th? What happens then is that if you're looking at this from an American perspective, the United States has an ally in Israel. Doesn't like Netanyahu. I mean, Trump likes Netanyahu. Biden doesn't. Has an ally in Israel. And if the United States does not jump in and support Israel, Hamas was very clear about the fact that it was attacking the way it was because it expected the Arabs in Israel and the Houthis and Hezbollah to jump in. If they had jumped into Israel, we would be at war right now, right? So what does Biden do is he sends the two carrier groups, and those aren't just ships, those are helicopters and submarines and troops and all that, to the region, and he and Blinken both go repeatedly in front of the cameras and say to anybody else thinking about getting involved, don't. And you can actually search their speeches for the word don't, because they kept repeating it, don't. Because their main interest initially was to make sure that that did not spread. Now, of course, Hamas, the Houthis, and Hezbollah were quite happy to have it spread if they wanted to, but it's worth remembering that those states, those are non-state actors. Those are not Arab states. Those are non-state actors. So one of the things that happens from the very beginning is the Arab states do not get involved. Did you notice that? And they actually had a number of pieces in places like the Washington Post and in the Christian Science Monitor and a number of places where Arab state leaders said, Israel, did you notice we're not fighting here? Did you notice this? So now is your time to make peace with the idea of a two-state solution. So what you're seeing, and I would say I think, but you can see it, you can read this for yourself, the Arab states and the Biden administration have all insisted on a two-state solution. And Egypt introduced the initial plans for a two-state solution on Christmas Day. I know not a lot of people didn't see that. But again, they've been showing up in a number of places where Arab states are getting together and saying, we're willing to solve the Middle East crisis once and for all. Who's not willing to do that? Hamas, the Houthis, the Hezbollah, and Netanyahu's government. So one of the things that you're seeing right now is the attempt to work around Netanyahu's government. I don't know if you noticed this about 4 days ago now, maybe five, maybe even last week, but I don't think so. There was a story that was leaked to Axios in which it said that Secretary of State Antony Blinken had asked for a report on what the UN could do to recognize a two-state solution even without Netanyahu's support. And so I think what you're seeing, and one of the reasons that the U.S. has not been willing to get behind what they call a ceasefire, they have never used the word ceasefire, they've used the word a pause in fighting, is because they want to make sure they can bring this about. And one of the things just that, again, doesn't get a lot of press, if you remember when Biden went over in October, on October 10th, he did that. He went to Israel, first president to go to war zone twice, by the way. He went to Israel specifically as an exchange for opening aid to Gaza, because the Netanyahu government had said, we're going to turn it into a parking lot. They said no fuel, no, and no water. And that really the fuel really matters because it's the fuel that runs the desalination station, so that would really have killed everybody there. Remember that? And then within a week, they're saying, okay, we're going to let people come in again through the gate, through the first the Arab gate, and then they opened another one later on. So the administration has, and they say every day, you know, Netanyahu is not doing this right. But from the very beginning, they have been saying, we need to respond to Hamas, but you need to do it in a legitimate way. And actually now they've come out, I think it was today or yesterday, and said, we're done. You're not following the rules, and you can't have aid unless you follow the humanitarian rules that you claimed you were going to. So yeah, it's a mess. But it's a mess that might, with an emphasis and an underline under might, end up with a two-state solution. And that's a game changer, because then all those non-state actors, Hezbollah, Houthis, and Hamas, have nothing to stand on because the Palestinians finally got their state. It's that regionalism again.
So we have time for another question. One.
Hi. Thank you. One, yeah, my favorite number. Could you comment on abortion? I think there's not much play. It's almost 2 years since the Dobbs decision. Few months from now. And it hasn't blown over as some members of the Supreme Court might have thought it would or liked to have seen it do, but it's still out there, as you mentioned, in Texas, but not just in Texas. I mean, all across the country. And I think Republican women are getting energized, but nobody's really talking about it. The candidates aren't talking about it. Isn't that going to become a dominant issue in this campaign, not just for the presidency, but all down the ballot?
Well, so of course, Vice President Kamala Harris is talking about it all the time. But it's funny you say that, because I was at a meeting recently and somebody said, well, you know, what are you going to do to make this a salient issue again? And every woman at the table looked at the man and said, do you honestly think that women have forgotten about this? You know, and so yeah, I mean, I think it's significant that in every special election, all seven of them since the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health decision, Democrats have outperformed by 8 points. And I absolutely think that's going forward. But I'm going to say something more about it than just being the issue of abortion. I think the sheer disrespect of that decision for women in the United States has created this movement. And one of the things, just to go back to our friend Taylor, that fascinates me about the Eras Tour and about everything that she is doing is that her concerts and the intergenerational bonding at those concerts around the message of female empowerment is, I think, symbolic of the movement that we're in right now that in many ways is driven by women. And I have heard recently former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talk about the extraordinary misogyny that you've seen in places like Israel and in Hamas's attacks and in the United States and in a number of other countries as being a blowback from the fact that women finally are taking control of governments. And that, I think, is the moment we're in now, and it's real touch and go. But is it going to be salient? I think it's foundational, because it's not even just about abortion, even though huge though that is. It's about whether or not we're going to include women as equals in American society. And, you know, like I said, I think there's a big movement out here that is not being seen by dudes like the guy who was like, how are you going to make it salient in 2024?
So, on that note, reluctantly, we're going to have to end. Thank you so much for being with us, but we can't send you away empty-handed. So, I have been delegated to present you with the Mid-Coast Forum mug.
Oh, cool. Oh,
it's only about 400 other people have one. And when you're up in the middle of the night writing and thinking, you can maybe fill it with coffee
or my
caffeine.
Diet Dr. Pepper.
Your diet.
Well, I actually thank you very much for this. It is in fact gold, which is really cool. I hope it doesn't come off in the dishwasher. But I want to thank First Mid-Coast Forum for having me and for being able to be in this space. But also, I want to thank all of you not only for turning out tonight, but for the fact that I never lose sight of the fact that I am the luckiest woman in the world, because I get to keep the record of the United States in this, either its most dire or its greatest hour, and that I am able to do it because of you all. And that's why I get up every day and do it again, and why I stay up all those nights, and I could not do it without your support. And I just want to thank you all for being here. There's a reason that I dedicate my work to you all people. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.